Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2006. Today's session is entitled Ethical Responsibilities When Doing Business in Developing Countries, presented by Steve Balls. Number BAH-S-2006-04. Let us listen in.
Session on corporate responsibility. We'll be talking about corporate responsibility most of this week. I think most of the people here who were here last week are gone, so we started last week and continue to talk about it. The syllabus, we kind of jump around in the syllabus, so I provide it primarily as a handout. I invite you to turn to the second page, however, of the syllabus, page 2. Just to reflect what the ELCA has to say about corporate responsibility. As you know, the ELCA has an office that deals with issues of corporate responsibility, and the ELCA tells us that it is the obligation of the church as a corporation and its members individually to be concerned about corporate responsibility, to be committed to practice good stewardship of creation, pursue justice, care for people in need, and seek things that make for peace. Last time we talked a little bit about emerging world standards for corporate responsibility. We looked at the global Sullivan principles last time. We looked at some United Nations pronouncements, which are in your material. And we looked at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and their rather detailed standard of international corporate responsibility, which many people feel is an evolving standard. It requires more corporate responsibility than is required by the law. Tonight, we are going to look at obligations of United States businesses when locating in other countries, obligations concerning labor standards, environmental standards, taxation standards, bribes, and so on. There aren't a lot of right answers to some of the questions that I'm going to be talking about tonight when I ask you what those standards should be. But we know a few things about the United States conducting business abroad. We know as a general rule that when United States companies conduct business abroad, that United States law does not apply to those operations abroad. So, for example, if a United States clothing manufacturer is assembling clothing in Thailand, for example, obviously the hour and wage rate rules don't apply, labor rules don't apply, pollution laws don't apply. There are some exceptions to that. One of the exceptions is that wherever a United States business does business, those businesses are not to engage in bribery. That is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It is the largest exception to the general rule that when United States businesses do business abroad, that in fact they are not controlled by U.S. law. There are some other exceptions to that. There was a Supreme Court case that asked about employment discrimination and management. What happens if a company does business, a United States company, for example, in Saudi Arabia, and discriminates? United States Supreme Court held that United States law does not apply to protect that United States citizen employed by a United States corporation in Saudi Arabia. The United States Congress overturned that decision. So employment law does have some reach as it relates to anti-discrimination against American citizens doing business
so
abroad.
Against
American citizens doing business
abroad.
Not against
Saudi citizens.
Not against Saudi citizens. So, as a result, then, when a U.S. corporation does business abroad, it is bound by the laws of the jurisdiction in which it does business. Many times, those laws are much laxer than in the United States. In some cases, sub-Saharan Africa, for example, there is very little law to regulate how business works. In many, many cases, laws applied to businesses abroad can be waived, so to speak, through the payments of bribes. So we like to think of us holding our own businesses in the United States to a fairly high standard. Often the standards then are much lower when companies do business abroad, particularly in developing countries. Now, there was an effort by Cynthia McKinnon, the Congresswoman McKinnon, to require United States businesses doing business abroad to adhere to a basic code of conduct, similar to the Sullivan principles, similar to these evolving norms. And Congress did not pass that particular piece of legislation. Let's pause here and ask whether you think that's a good idea. Is it a good idea for Congress to say that those corporations based in the United States, incorporated in the United States, that do business abroad ought to be held to a set of rules for corporate responsibility when doing business abroad? Rules relating to wages, rules relating to pollution, rules relating to bribery. Is that a good idea?
Yes.
Well, yes. It puts American corporations at a competitive disadvantage because the European corporations are not held to similar standards.
President Bush made that argument. President Bush opposed this piece of legislation using that very argument, and that argument carried the day with respect to Congress. Now, like so many bills, this gets buried in committee and you don't know who is for it and who is against it. But what do you make of that argument? I mean, that's an argument that I think ought to give us a little pause. That is, that it puts U.S. businesses at a competitive disadvantage. Is that then a sufficient reason to defeat legislation like that? Yes, Paul?
What about, corporations are disadvantaged, but how about the workers? It seems to me that who are we going to favor? It does, right?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
These standards in Congressman McKinnon's bill were very general standards. They were standards which were similar to the Sullivan principles. The Sullivan principles are found in your handout. These are not standards that say that we need to pay $7.50 an hour wherever you do business. These are standards that say that we need to pay a living wage wherever you do business. We need to respect the rights of labor to organize wherever we do business. We need to not pay bribes. That's part of the law already. So very, very general standards. Many U.S. corporations have signed on to these standards, the Global Sullivan principles and other standards. So it's not like corporations cannot operate under those standards. Many do. But clearly it is a competitive disadvantage. Yes.
In the development literature, in the developing world, one of the things that developing countries really want to encourage is foreign direct investment.
Mm-hmm.
So they have problems because many developing countries have a history of defaulting on foreign bonds, and so they want to encourage firms to come in a way that will create investment, and training in human capital and that sort of thing. And so it may be that we don't want to be limiting the opportunities for American corporations to do that sort of thing by restricting their American end options. I think if you want to go to a foreign country, here's what you have to do, and therefore restrict the amount of foreign direct investment.
Well, you know, this is part of the dilemma. If you assume that most foreign direct investment is good for a country, and you do anything to restrict that foreign direct investment, such as, say, to U.S. corporations, if you're going to make that investment, you need to comply with these rules, are you not injuring the company? For example, if the prevailing wage rate in a developing country is 30 or 40 cents an hour, and a U.S. Company is going to pay 50 cents an hour, but that's still not a very good living wage in that country, should we prohibit it or shouldn't we prohibit it? That is the issue. Any thoughts? Yes.
I think the government should make rules for themselves to follow first, and should they work, then we could talk about, are they enforceable for corporations?
Well, you know, you raise a good point. There is a maxim that a corporate responsibility is a two-way street. To have corporate responsibility you need to have good corporate practices and good governmental practices. My view is to encourage corporations to be responsible in the way they conduct business in the United States is to have socially responsible management or conscious management, but to have a strong and effective system of laws to ensure that responsibility. The problem in many developing countries is that there is not a strong system of government, or there is not a system of government that has thought much about the impact of business on the people. Now, that varies from place to place. Often where there is a strong system of government, it can break down through a bribery or lack of local control. Then, if a U.S. corporation goes into a developing country where there is not a strong system of government, that maxim breaks down. To have corporate responsibility, you need two things: socially responsible corporations, management, and a strong governmental system. I would submit to you then that the first piece of that equation, socially responsible management, needs to take a firmer role and ask how we are going to do it free of government regulation. Let's talk about a hypothetical and talk about if you are associated with this U.S. Corporation, how you deal with some of the issues on the board. Would we ever move a corporate operation, set up a plant in a country with a repressive government? We're going to talk about that for a minute. Would we ever go there? And should we ever go there? Would we ever pay bribes? If, in fact, paying bribes is the norm within that country, and paying bribes is the only way to get things done. If there are lax or no environmental regulations, how ought we regulate ourselves in these countries? What sort of wages ought we pay? If the prevailing wage rate is 25 cents an hour, should we feel good if we pay 26 cents an hour? What about technology transfer? Is there any obligation to transfer technology to host countries, that is, countries in which we are doing business? If you can negotiate taxes with the government, which I understand you can, in many countries, should we do that? How much should we engage in political activities? Should we speak out in third world countries or other countries against wrongdoing? If the government is pretty sound when we locate but becomes corrupt, what should we do? And how should we deal with suppliers? Now, these are the questions that are very real questions when U.S. businesses locate abroad in those countries that have weak governance zones.
Steve, is the internet making it easier to communicate as a country? So, you know, all these boycotts and things that people do. Is that having any effect on practices?
Yes, I think the internet is having an effect on practices. We'll talk a little bit about that at the end. We're going to set up in our next half hour together what we think we ought to do, and then we're going to ask how we can encourage businesses to really do that. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development recently, this year, came out with a white paper on this very issue. I don't think it's the greatest piece of work, but it's a white paper called OECD Risk Awareness Tools for Multinational Corporations in Weak Governance Zones. That is, what are our social responsibilities in weak governance zones? Let's set up the hypothetical and ask some of the questions. Let's assume that it is a United States pharmaceutical company. Assume that that pharmaceutical company is going to manufacture, package AIDS drugs in Africa, in a developing country in Africa. It has chosen Africa because wage rates are low. They need to assemble, package these drugs. It's less expensive. There is much export to Europe, and it is easier to export to Europe, let us assume, from Africa than it is from the United States. Let's assume that a chemical process is used by the drug manufacturer in the process of manufacturing drugs, and assume that in this developing country or third world country, that there are weak environmental laws, that you're allowed to bury waste. Let us assume that the pharmaceutical company also is has had a downturn in profitability. That is why they are looking at this weak stock prices, and their stock prices have not kept up with the stock market. Assume this country is a friend of the United States. This country talks a lot about democracy. This country has a significant Muslim minority population, and that the tax laws are favorable because this is a democracy in a significantly Muslim area, let us assume, for bringing income back into the United States. That's what makes this investment a good investment. Is it an unrealistic case? I don't think so. Don't think it's an unrealistic case at all. Let us ask the initial question, which is not assumed in this case, but let us assume that it is a repressive government, a government that represses the minority, and a government that relocates the minority, and a government where minority leaders tend to disappear. Should we ever invest in a country like that?
We do all the time.
We do all the time.
Doesn't make it right, though.
Yeah.
Should we invest in Mexico?
Certainly, as a Christian would say, no, that's not what God's calling us to do. As a company, say, well, gee, this is the only country in Africa, the only country in Africa that we can set up our company. So there must be some other countries.
Okay, there's certainly other countries. That's a good point. We don't need to invest in this one country. There are other countries that are less repressive. Does it do anything for the people in a country where the government is repressive to have U.S. investment? Should we take that into account?
How many people are you going to employ?
Let's say we're going to employ a couple thousand people. This is going to be a big operation.
And we're going to be the leaders. We're bringing over our management or whatever.
We're going to bring over our management, yeah. Okay. We're going to bring over our management expertise.
Will we assume that the unemployment rate is very high?
We'll assume that the unemployment rate is very high. We'll also assume that it's customary for children to work in factories. We'll assume that many young people, women, are employed as prostitutes because that is the easiest way to make a living, and that we can stop some of that from happening by paying decent wages. But it is a repressive government. They are going to tax us, and our revenues are going to go to that repressive government.
And how closely are they going to monitor our actions?
How closely is who going to?
The repressive government. You know, are they going?
Well, that's a good point. I think the point you're making is if they're repressing the minority, they may repress us also.
Right.
I mean, that's a business consideration. But
that's
maybe
what the bribes are for.
Yeah, but maybe we can cozy up to them. Yeah,
that's what the bribes are for.
Sure enough. Yeah. Yeah, the minority can't bribe, but we can. We have the economic power.
How many places that we're talking about in this scenario don't have repressive governments?
Well, it depends upon the definition of a repressive government,
but
does it not?
What you started with, just the three things, cover pretty much everybody.
Repressing minorities.
Repressing some minorities. Physically moving people around,
yeah.
and killing opposition leaders,
yeah.
in Canada.
Yeah.
That's all Latin America, Mexico, all of Africa, Great Britain, Asia. We cover China, we cover India.
Is America repressive?
Yeah. If we America is repressive. We'll talk about legal bribery in America in a few minutes here. Paul?
Hasn't that been part of a, and this is a question I don't know, part of a foreign policy that's one way of undoing a government by bringing our industry and manufacturing there as opposed to going in and dropping bombs on them?
Yeah, and I don't know whether that's... you know, a formal part of our foreign policy, but it sure sounds familiar.
Clinton
does it.
A lot
yeah,
of that.
Yeah, sure. It sure sounds familiar. You try to bring U.S. Capitalism and U.S. employment to a government, hoping that good things will happen. I think it's an interesting question. I think as interesting is how is that decision made? Who makes that decision? Well, that's made by management of a corporation. But you do see shareholders' resolutions on this. That is, churches primarily, with shareholders' resolutions, wanting certain companies to get out of certain areas because of repressive governments. It is a tough issue, and it's an issue for which there are two sides, yes.
I think you also have the same issue that you have when it relates to aid, which is that unemployment doesn't hurt the government nearly as much as it hurts the individual people. And the other, sort of the corollary to that is when you have a government that is really backed against the wall, they tend to become more repressive. And sometimes, you know, I mean, repression doesn't just come out of thin air either. A lot of times, part of the repression is the government itself is being pressed. And it's at least possible that that investment could be, you know, a way of diffusing attention.
Yeah. Let's ask about China. I mean, has all the investment in China stopped that repressive government?
No, it hasn't.
But it's certainly changed it.
So, well, it's changed it. For those of you who were here the other day, I've spent some time in China, and you know, I believe that the repression there, while serious, is and while widespread, not everyone is repressed. Most people are not repressed, but. Has it made democracy come about? No, now it'll be interesting when China has a recession and kind of this pact that the Chinese government has made with its citizens that will have outstanding economic growth, but really no participatory democracy. We'll see what happens there. I don't know the answer to this question. I do know, however, that it ought to not always be simply corporate management that makes that decision. The shareholders, that's fodder for a shareholder's resolution. Reasonable minds can differ there. If one goes into a country with a repressive government, one can enter into some bargains, perhaps, with that country. One can affiliate with other businesses and try to be a force for social change in that country. But at the same time, you can fuel the repression, too, through tax revenues and creating a greater vehicles. It is a very, very difficult question, and it's a question that we should all think about. It's a question that does not have an easy answer to me.
I'm struck by the way the question is framed. And is framed in terms of our interface, our interaction, our impact in a third world situation or some such thing. I mean, you chose pharmaceuticals. That was kind of an easy one. Let's choose oil.
Yeah.
And our addiction to oil is feeding the most repressive regimes in the world. That's where the money's going. And so by framing the question out there, instead of turning it around and looking at our own habits, it begins to become a different question.
I think that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. The case that I posit is a little easier in some ways because where you manufacture these things doesn't make a lot of difference. Oil has a different geopolitical dynamic, certainly. Let us ask about bribery. I think it is safe to say that bribery is something that is more common outside of the United States than inside of the United States. Now, some people would quarrel with that. Do we have bribery inside the United States? I don't know. You know, we were talking about campaign contributions for access. We were talking about hiring a lobbyist and so on. Is that legalized bribery? I don't know. But how would you feel about obtaining business permits and being asked to pay $100,000 to obtain the business permit in the municipality? For $100,000, the permit would waive any inspection of the factory for safety issues or environmental issues, and that is customary to do that. Would you do that? It's a pretty easy one.
Well, it's against U.S. law to do that, but that highlights another problem, is that we have a law that is putting our corporations at a competitive disadvantage. It's a good law.
Yeah.
Because bribery throughout Asia is so widespread. Right? But the Germans and the English and the French are beating us in Asia as a result of that law. So here I would fault the sort of right-wing, nationalistic, anti-international administrations that we have had in Washington over the past several years, you know, that turn their nose up at Kyoto. There's an excellent example of how the industrialized nations of the world can get together and come up with an anti-bribery statute that they'll all agree to. But America, in its present state, is not about to agree to any sort of internationally binding compact.
Right. And because we don't have good, because we don't have government leadership that is interested in applying corporate responsibility standards throughout the world, it is then incumbent upon corporate managers to do that. And that is the tough thing. You have an excellent point there. What about bribes, John? I know you have an opinion on that.
This doesn't make this thing of what you just said about America is a political action contribution a bribe? Is contributing to political parties a bribe? Is it? No, we say it's not a bribe because it's legitimate attempts to influence the political system.
Hidden way, it seems.
No, it's not hidden. And in fact, our system says there's a whole bunch of ways. You can get money, you can vote, you can campaign, you can pass out leaflets. There's a whole range of things that are legitimate to do to affect the political system. And certain things aren't. And we define those in America as bribes or corruption. Right? And so the law draws a line at attempting to influence the government through certain ways, it's perfectly legitimate, and it's our right. And through other ways, it's not. And so when we transfer that, how can we transfer it?
Right.
Can we say, our law must be what we obey when we go to a foreign, or we say their law? You know, I think it's an impossible morass.
Well, I think I don't know that it's an impossible morass. I think a bribery, for example. And bribery is one of the few areas where the international community in recent years has been able to get together. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development has pronounced, and its member jurisdictions, even Greece now, you know, has an anti-bribery statute. China has anti-bribery rules. Now, the question in China, of course, is enforcement of these statutes. It's one thing to have them on the books. It's another thing to enforce them. What about paying the official $200,000 for a permit? Now the permits cost $100,000, but it takes 1 year to get the permit. What about paying an extra $100,000 to get it in 2 weeks? You're entitled to the permit.
Well, don't we do that to Holden here? I mean, if you have to have a personal call, you put a dollar with it, and the bed and breakfast will call. You know, it's a minor thing, but it's one of those things that we do in schools. I'm a teacher, and we say, you know, we take away that gift of giving by saying, oh, it's a service thing, and you got to do it for credit, kind of thing.
Right.
You know, and it's just at a bigger level.
And that's called Greece money. Greece. I taught about this in Greece, but it's not that type of Greece. But it's a Greece money. That is paying a public official to do something that they have to do anyway, and just speeding it up. You know, a bribe in its rankest form is to pay a public official to do something that the public official should not do, that violates the law. What about Greece money? Would you pay that? That is very customary in other countries. Paying Greece money is not a violation of the United States Foreign Corrupt Practices Act because it does not fall within the definition of a bribe, that is paying someone a fee, a government official a fee, for something that is contrary to that nation's law. Just speeds it up.
So it's kind of a right and wrong thing. And
right.
I know you said it was a right, but is it right? You know, I'm just looking at that.
I got to tell you a story about Greece money. You know, when I started teaching law students about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, I thought Greece money should be included in the definition of a bribe because you're stepping out of line, you're getting an unfair advantage for money. One summer I was taking a group of students from Greece to Turkey. As you know, the relationships between Greece and Turkey aren't very good. And we got to the border. and there was a long lineup, and the bus driver said, you're likely to be here 5 hours in this lineup before you can go. Unless you pay the border guard to hand him with the passports, $3.50 U.S. per student. So I thought about that long and hard as the students were getting unruly. Well, it's not illegal. It's and he said, well, there's one other thing. You have to have the women do that because they like talking to the women in the parties. Well, I didn't want the women to do anything illegal, and it wasn't illegal, so the women and I went. And even though Capital was a Lutheran school, we paid grease money to get out of the hot sun. I've always wondered about that. But bribery certainly is something that is rampant in other countries. The argument that you often hear to support paying bribes is that public officials aren't paid much or aren't paid anything, and that's kind of how they make their living. How does that argument break down? I don't know where that's true, but they're breaking the law in their country. To accelerate a permit, I suppose so. I mean, they're just holding you up, aren't they? Everyone at that border was going through with money in their passports, and it's just the way that business is done. No one is breaking a law there. No one is necessarily breaking a law here. Yes, sir?
I think the difficulty of it is the weight of, you know, even an average American citizen, the weight of how much economic power we have relative to some of these third world countries. I mean, you go to a country where a doctor makes $30 a month, you know, and $5 for us is a very trivial amount of money. But I think the ultimate effect of this grease, that the grease money and bribes has, is that it really undermines the will of people to actually make a realistic economy for themselves. And in my experience with it, is incredibly corrosive. And it starts at one level and it just keeps going, and it's extremely corrosive.
Yeah, bribery is extremely corrosive. There's no doubt about it. How one business can stop bribery, I don't know. All businesses getting together. That is the attempt of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which I believe has had some significant impact. Had this been a bribe at the border to do something that the border guard would not, I wouldn't have paid it, first because I'd be criminally liable in the United States. But it is corrosive. I mean, that's how the system works. Everyone sits there, you know, unless they pay the $350 per head, and they pay the $350 per head. I really thought about that. I was like, gosh, this is a Lutheran college. I'm a law school dean, but I had researched grease money, so I knew the law in that regard.
Let's say $350 was illegal. So you give them a candy bar that's worth $5. I mean,
and we gave them cigarettes and cokes too. Oh, that's the other one. Yeah, right. Right.
So they would just skirt that little law. If we make a law that says X amount of money is illegal, then they do something else, service.
Yeah. It is an interesting question, and it is not optional. We don't have, as U.S. corporations and U.S. citizens, kind of the ability to wonder whether we should pay bribes or not. It's defined in a classic bribe, paying a foreign official money to do something that they should not do. We have no choice. We can't do that. There is an evolving norm not to do that. Grease money certainly is rampant. Payment, private bribes, payment to suppliers and so on, continues to be rampant. That is not illegal under the United States Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Yes?
This is just a reversal. A lot of our immigration, the people who come here from a lot of these developing countries, are so used to that methodology that you find it in all of the businesses here that deal with everything from fresh produce. We don't keep records, we just do the little exchange, whatever it is. And I mean, you could see that. It gets a little difficult then when you go a certain level of business.
Yeah.
Then you have to comply. And then the underground stuff goes on anyway, but at a different level.
Right. Yeah. Private bribes, of course, are rampant, not illegal outside of the United States, at least. Now, if you pay a private bribe, there are another set of civil liability problems, but a great observation. Let's move on to environmental regulations. Now, we've indicated in our hypothetical that the in the manufacture of these AIDS drugs that there's a chemical process used, and in this developing country there is essentially no environmental law. Be okay to dump it behind and bury it. What standards should we hold ourselves to?
Ours.
Ours?
Much higher.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think management's going to say about that of U.S. corporations?
No, they won't do it.
They got to want to do it as cheaply as possible. That's why they're going to those foreign countries versus doing it in the U.S. They get by as cheaply as they can. And you mentioned that their stock isn't doing very well, so they want to move plant and hope that it'll bring the stock up. So they need to do everything they're interested in. Their message is to do to get by as cheaply as possible.
Well, you know, you've made an interesting observation. In my experience, some of the internationally most responsible corporations are some of our most profitable corporations in America. I would submit to you that it is easier to be responsible when you're profitable than responsible when you're fighting for your life. Jane?
Well, just I think this is where public reputation comes in. If you talk about what's management going to say about it, well, what happens? It doesn't take long on the internet for, you know, somebody who's doing a little rooting around to find out that the XYZ pharmaceutical company's African plant is dumping toxic chemicals, you know, behind the factory and polluting the land there. And, you know, that gets out on the internet or gets into press, and you've got all kinds of problems like wake-ups and all kinds of stuff like that. And so it might be a good stock price supportive sort of thing to do to follow U.S. law.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. The logic of why we regulate environmental behavior firms in the United States has nothing to do with their profits. It has to do with the fact that when they pollute, they impose costs on other people for which they're not charged. So the market cannot regulate that. There are attempts to do that in some way. But the principle here is that you're taking an action, right, which potentially has wide implications. And that's the same logic with the environmental in the third world country. You're taking an action which potentially has effects on people who live in America or wherever. You know, you're burying nuclear waste or release HIV. And we should be protecting against that no matter where it is.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the U.S. companies want a short term, you know, for the stock, you know, 3 months or something, and I think
But I think it's safe to say that we know companies don't always do that.
Right.
That companies often locate abroad, so they don't have to comply with strict environmental standards. Should they? I would agree with you that they should. Yes.
Yeah, I was struck in reading the ELC statements on the environment and economic statement. By the word used in both statements is sustainability. And when we talk about loose environmental standards, I personally think standards in the United States have been loosened up in the last 6 years, and I would not hold companies accountable to the standards as they are now, but to biblical standards about what creation is. And that whatever practices they are, wherever they are in the world, that they should be sustainable practices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The emerging international standards here with respect to environmental protection as found in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development are a little disappointing. According to the emerging guidelines for multinational enterprises, here is the standard. Observe. I'm on the wrong page here. Adopt technologies and operating procedures in all parts of the enterprise that reflect standards concerning environmental performance in the best performing part of the enterprise. That is a little confusing standard. As I read it, you take the best performing part of your enterprise, and that establishes then the minimum of environmental standards. Well, the best performing part of your enterprise could be the part of the enterprise located in the country with the worst environmental standards. I don't know. Do you read that differently?
Well, I think you can say best performing in terms of environmental standards or best performing in terms of the company.
Now, that could
and
be.
It's confusing. When you read that, because you read that yesterday.
Yeah, let me read it again. Adoption of technologies and operating standards in all parts of the enterprise that reflect the standards concerning environmental performance in the best performing part of the enterprise. It is confusing. It could be read that,
yeah,
that way.
Right.
Yeah. Could well be. The OECD, though, has quite a bit of additional analysis here. Assuming you're walking into a country and you can do what you want. Now, you might look at your best, your highest standard and apply that standard. But you need to do an environmental impact statement. You should do an environmental impact statement. You should share that environmental impact statement with the country and community in which you are operating. You should set public standards with respect to the amount of emission. You should report back on those public standards. You should have contingency plans in case there is an environmental release. So it's not necessarily only limited to applying which law do we apply, but being transparent in the actions and being and consulting with a host countries, not only the central government but the communities. Labor standards. What should we pay? Prevailing wage is 25 cents an hour.
We'll probably pay 25. Unfortunately,
I don't think that's a practice. I don't think that's a practice. In the reading that I have done, if it's 25 cents, it wouldn't be uncommon to pay 40 or 50 cents an hour. These are usually some of the best paying jobs when U.S.
Is it still a livable wage?
Often it is. Often it is. Often it is not. But how would you peg it then? You're suggesting a livable wage.
A livable wage.
Yeah.
Whatever that standard would have to be within a country, and it could be different from country to country, that we would have to pay so that person can live. Like you say, not to have to go out and be a prostitute.
We don't do that here.
We don't do
it here. I know. We don't do it here, and that's bad too. There's no excuse for that, and there's no excuse for doing it and not doing it in other countries.
The standard, according to the OECD again, is that you pay the higher of a livable wage or the prevailing wage in the country. So the higher of 25 cents an hour, or if a livable wage is 50 cents. Now, the devil's in the detail, is it not? What is a livable wage?
Right.
What a standard and so on?
How much does a Coke cost in that country?
Yeah, right.
Or a latte.
That's a bad, a latte, because wherever I've been, it's expensive.
That's right.
Yeah, good point.
In America, big corporations pay higher wages for the same job than small businesses do, almost invariably, right? And the reason is they want to get the best people, right? So when the wage you pay to the average worker is the wage you pay for the average worker. And so if you want to attract better workers, you pay higher wages, you get them. So these guys go to these countries, and they want to attract better workers, and they can do it very cheaply. So they typically pay higher wages. And that really should cause us a problem. Because we say, oh, that's not a living wage, so you shouldn't go there. Then we're denying those people the possibility of increasing their standard of living. Because their standard of living is how they live, no matter how we want to define it as, whether they're livable or not.
That's right.
And so these companies very often, I would say predominantly, are raising living standards in the places where they're going.
That's the argument that's often made. That 25 cents an hour is better than no cents an hour. You know,
yeah.
They didn't have a job before. They're still getting 25 cents an hour. That's fantastic. So they're starving while they're making money. You bet. At least they got a job. They got a job. So
that's right.
25 cents an hour.
The press sometimes demonizes multinational corporations, but economists agree. Would you agree, John, that multinational corporations have raised the standard of living in many countries in which they've located? Yes?
Yeah, I'm concerned, I guess, with the larger, maybe philosophical issue of, we're talking about standard of living wage. And I'm curious, I guess, what that really means. Does that mean enough money to buy TV in which to watch American shows that import our culture into their indigenous culture so that they can consume more American products? I mean, is that a higher standard of living? Is that quality of life?
Well,
that's the plan.
I think that's an interesting question. And let's suppose do we have a company store? Like there was a company store here, I assume. And do we in the company store because we want to raise the standard of living, have TVs? And,
I mean, in terms of standard of living, there are a lot of places where, you know, indigenous cultures live sustainably. Granted, you know, this is, yes, the world is changing and globalization is happening, et cetera, but in terms of, you know, looking at indigenous ways of life where people fed themselves and lived a certain way, you know, compare that to a place where, oh, 40 cents an hour is a great wage because they can then buy stuff that is being produced. You know, I mean, that's, I don't know, it seems to me like there's a semantic issue here with standard.
No, I think your point is a good one. We talked about last time some of these evolving international codes. One of the United Nations codes, which was sponsored by the Netherlands and the Islamic Republic of Iran, said part of it is to respect a culture. We don't see that in many of our corporate codes, that when we establish a factory, we're going to respect a culture. But your point is an outstanding one, I think. Labor standards, interesting issues. The emerging world standard, according to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, is that we ought to not only employ factory workers in the country that in which we are located, but train management, help management develop skills. So if that factory is pulled out for one reason or another, that there is some a management skill and opportunity for development and other use of that factory. A lot of things to think about there. Anything else on labor? Yes.
Yeah, just the NGOs. We go in there as non-government. Like Cambodia, you may as well say, is run by NGOs. The government is so absent. And then they hire people. And I'm only asking then is, do they relate? A lot of them are faith-based. Do they have a, does corporate world talk to those people? You know, we went to Cambodia, you buy these shirts that everybody makes yourself for $15, you buy it for $2 there. The locals don't, but the NGOs do. And all of our people driving around in four-wheel drives, expensive ones, they're driving in their little shit vehicles. And I say it that way because it almost is that. You know, they have to go off to the side to do their thing because there's nothing, there's no infrastructure. So I'm just curious about NGOs because it's so huge in our system. We encourage young people to go to the NGO model, go to Peace Corps, do this service stuff, become servant leaders. We never tell them to become corporate leaders and go over there and, you know, save the world.
Oh, I might.
I'm just curious if there is a relationship between
I don't know.
World Vision pays its people versus Coke.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a good question, the relationship between those doing business abroad and NGOs. I do know that this document coming out from the OECD, which talks about doing business in countries where there is very little law, emphasizes the importance of building relationships with NGOs to speak out against a wrongdoing. Now, it's very pragmatic here. It says of a corporation, if you speak out against a wrongdoing, you're going to get your license. You know, cozy up to the NGOs and have them do it. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting how self-interest works here. Likewise, if the government becomes corrupt, you need to cozy up with the NGOs and those who you can't, because you might have to pull out and lose your investment. So I think that a business is serious about operating, particularly in those countries that have weak governments, that relationships with NGOs are critical. Yes, ma'am.
Curious about when you say, like, the developing nations with weak governments or very little law, what's the origin of that? What is the, how can we trace back why there are such weak standards for very little law there?
Well, that's a little bit beyond, I'll take a stab at that. Many of you may have greater knowledge of world history than I do, but you know, it goes back to the colonial system, these artificial borders breaking down what worked for year after year, and you get countries that are ineffective in a way. I'm sure it's more complex than that. The OECD says that 15% of those in the world live in essentially lawless situations without effective government control. Yes?
Yeah, back to labor standards. That also takes in effect safety standards.
Indeed it does.
And it seems like, well, in many places in the world, life is cheap. You know, a guy dies on the assembly line, they just go outside and get somebody else. If he dies at the hands of a business practice, not following a safety procedure or whatever, here we have workers come. The government watches people. You're killed doing your job, the government investigates.
Right. We visited, Jane and I, China. We visited an escalator factory with Professor Noam Moline from Augustana last summer. There was these big escalator steps. There was not a safety shoe in the place. There weren't safety glasses. But you point out something. If we can squeeze out additional return because as a corporation, because of foreign investment, is it worth it? Is it worth it when people's lives are at stake?
If your husband dies on the job and there's no safety net for you and you can't work there, you've done that family a disservice.
Yes. And indeed, the emerging international standards are that in matters of safety, we should apply those standards, high standards of the United States.
Wasn't it Shakespeare that said, first kill all the lawyers or something? And they take that out of context, but what if there were better lawyers in those third world or developing countries?
In the United States, 37 miners have died in the United States in the last 5 years. In China, 2,700 have died.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And the only place you can read about it is in The Economist.
And, you know, the owners of the corporations are who that are profiting from this? All of us. Our pension funds, our mutual funds, our life insurance funds. Comment about the lawyers. I mean, they're part of the problem in some of these countries. Essentially, what you do is you launder a lot of this by hiring a lawyer to set up the business or a business agent. They pay the bribes and so on, and you don't know about it. Sometimes the lawyers are the problem. Who drafts corporate codes of ethics in America? It's lawyers, isn't it? Now, that's kind of interesting. You know, we've turned to lawyers to draft codes of ethics. Why wouldn't it be pastors? Why wouldn't it be people from NGOs? It is defaulted to lawyers. Usually this is something assigned to the legal department. Now, is there a lot of participation? You bet there is. But I find that interesting. How are we doing time-wise? About 5 minutes left. Other comments?
One of the things you haven't mentioned is child labor. That's a terrific issue when you're going to a third world country.
Of course, emerging international standards to a standard indicate that United States corporations will not employ child labor. Now, what is child labor is an issue. Is it 16? Is it 15? Is it 14? Is it 17? Is it 18? People, you know, make a case for some employment of child labor when they look at what alternatives the children have, particularly the young women.
We have that same problem with immigrants to this country in the fruit picking areas.
Sure you do. Sure you do. But clearly, the international standard is no employment of child labor. What else do you want to talk about on the board? We haven't gotten. Yes?
I came a little bit late, so I'm curious. Are we talking about how it should be, like hypothetically, if we were all moral, or are we talking about is it really possible to do this? I mean, because it seems to me that as long as people in America want to buy a pair of shoes for $8 at Walmart and the CEOs of the company are making millions, you're not going to be able to place them in China.
Well, we're talking about how it should be. That is a nice transition, though, to move from how it should be. We've set some of us some pretty high standards. We're going to apply the United States. Some of us have suggested environmental standards. We're going to pay double the prevailing wage in the country, but be very strict with respect to safety. I should say technology transfer is a huge issue here. And that is evolving international standards would suggest that we ought to transfer some technology. Should we make these AIDS drugs available to people in the host country? should we license a manufacturer to people in the host country? If we don't want to do business in Africa, we don't want to sell AIDS drugs in Africa because we don't think we can make any money, should we license that technology? Evolving international standards, and I would say that from our viewpoint as a church would be yes. What is it about? It's about sustainability, isn't it? We need to think about what's going to happen when we stop manufacturing AIDS drugs in that country, when we stop assembling clothing. What are they going to be left with? We need to leave them with an infrastructure. We need to leave them with a set of people that have management skills. And there ought to be some licensing or technology transfers. So we leave them with something. So this is pie in the sky, though. We've set a pretty high standard for United States corporations. We've tried to temper it a little bit with realism here and being competitive. How do we make this happen? Are we powerless to make it happen?
When you say we, you're talking about
us. Us as individuals.
As stockholders, we can make it happen.
As stockholders, we can make it happen with shareholders' resolutions. Now, shareholders' resolutions, we'll talk about on Thursday, always get voted down, or almost always get voted down, but we can negotiate them. We can make a difference. Who runs corporations? Well, it may be some of you in the room that are in positions of responsibility. Consumers make a difference, perhaps, certainly with respect to child labor, knowing where they buy their clothing. If we are always going to buy the cheapest clothing, the cheapest VCR, there's less hope for consumers.
Made in China.
Anything else that can be done? We own these corporations. John?
I said last night, when I grew up, Made in Japan was bad.
Yeah, that was.
And we bought the stuff, and it made Japan better. And if we hadn't bought the stuff, it wouldn't be developed.
And now they say Sony is mostly owned by American.
Remember when people were worried that Sony bought the Japanese bought Rockefeller Center? You know, these are places that they can make things and get something going.
Nothing's happened in China yet. I mean, we keep buying Chinese products, but nothing's happened there. There's still the repressive government.
Let me take just a couple more comments. Yes.
I want to raise the issue of consumption in general and how it's so intrinsically linked with our definition of quality of life. I want to raise the issue of peak oil and the fact that if every person in China was driving a car like most Americans do, we'd need about five planets. I mean, just the Earth is a finite system, and we can't just, I mean, the concept to me of an economy that just grows, I mean, it doesn't make sense. There's no such thing as, sustainable growth. I mean, if you have sustainable growth of your liver in your body, and it just kept growing sustainably, well, that'd be cancer. I mean, it's getting too big for the function. So,
I think your point's a good one. We're talking about sustainability here, which is part of the bottom line here. How can we sustain cultures and how can we sustain employment? There are many paths to that. Certainly, reducing demand for oil dramatically would help us in many ways with sustainability. I look at it a little differently, but I think your point is a very good one, because I don't think that's going to happen. I think people are going to continue to shop at the Walmarts and continue to drive the cars until the market mechanism stops them. What can we do within the realm of the law, within responsible management, to encourage sustainability? But there are many paths to encouraging sustainability. Two more closing comments. Yes.
This is the first time I ever heard this. It was one of those international reports on gambling and the gross product of whole, and the three top three, anybody? America, of course.
America, yeah.
I mean, in the multi-millions. Mm-hmm.
Right.
The next one, I was shocked, Africa.
Hmm.
And the third one didn't shock me at all, because that's what I assume they do, and they do, is Asia. It's the largest business
right now, aside from the web and porn, also an interesting business. But aside from that, the gambling, though, does strike me as Africa. I always thought, well, I had no money over there. They're all poor. You know, my image was like, where does it come from? So maybe we go up there and buy their lottery tickets. I don't know. Right. You might think about it.
One other closing comment. Thank you. That does surprise me. Yes.
You know, if you think about economic growth, you don't want to blow the thing up proportionally. Right, so most of what is in our economy is services. So think about sending an email today, and think about sending an email on the Pony Express. So the 100 million messages that go back and forth today would be hundreds of millions of horses, and hundreds of millions of riders, and tons of crap. Right? So that's economic growth, right? That consumes far less resources than something which provided far less utility did 100 years ago.
Look at what people we would have employed. You know, we're going about employing people.
The fact that you're growing does not mean, number one, that you're using more resources. But right?
What makes you say that the internet consumes less resources?
Look at it this way. There are two things that have created more jobs in America in the last 20 years than anything else. Sand and brain power.
Computer chips.
Right. Uh-huh. It's like economic growth, the more people you can employ, the better off things are. So rather than people arguing about increasing, say, this is a stupid argument, I bet, but nonetheless, instead of arguing about increasing the minimum wage, let's talk about decreasing the minimum wage. Then the company's going to have more people. Mm-hmm. You know, the employee is as well off. The company has more employees, can produce more goods because they're cheaper. I can buy the goods cheaper than I could before. And so we're better off economically. Some people are suffering, too bad, but aren't we better off economically?
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. The limitations I have, and I see my boss over here, is to wrap this up within an hour. We can continue the conversation informally. Tomorrow morning we'll be talking about corporate codes of ethics, and we've kind of drafted a code of ethics here, and we'll be talking about how to draft codes of ethics that work, that are enforceable, and that are measurable. There are some fine examples of corporations out there with great codes of ethics. There are many examples of corporations with codes of ethics, in my opinion, that are window addressing. So thank you. I always learn so much from you.